Mr. Ken Chisholm, Reel 9.
And they would say to us in no uncertain terms, you know, you go home. And as it turned out, I was very pleased to get a boat back from Calcutta back to Rangoon, and I got back to Kalore, and it was funny, but on the way up on the train, we passed another train going down. It was going down towards Rangoon, and the chaps was looking out, and I saw my pal Ted, and of course they passed each other quite slowly, really. And I said to Ted, "Well, where are you going then?" And he said, "I'm going home." And he had come back. He'd got a draft back from Calcutta a bit before me. We in the transit camp, when we had the parades of the morning and they picked out for duties, the first thing they done, if there was any boats going, they just called out a list of names, and you get your kit packed and you'll be going on the boat back to Rangoon. And it wasn't a case of you saying, "Oh well, I'll go with my mates" or anything of that. It was just that you were picked and that was it. So Ted came down, and that was the last I ever saw of him. I got back to Kalore and reported back into the into the office, and the orderly sergeant said to me, he said, "I've been looking for you." He said your B release is through. And so I said, "Oh," I said, "Oh, is it?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "He said we'll let you know." He said, "You know, when there's a boat, when you can go." And I stopped in that camp for, I think it was about three weeks before there was a boat back. And
what did you do during that time?
And in that time. Hardly anything, really. I was back in they still had the mules, and I was back there, and it was just a case of just looking after them, and really they didn't seem to know what was going to happen with them, and so they didn't bother with us too much, and the work was going on, still building up the camp. And there was quite a bit of activity, and really there was we had quite had an easy time, but it was funny, really. One day there, a Japanese prisoner said to me about a cigarette, and he would give me two drawings of geisha girls and for a cigarette. And
did you ask to look at the drawings first?
No, I gave him a cigarette, and he said he would have them tomorrow. And he was right. He was fair and right, and I got them. I've got them at home now, and I've just, after all these years, I've just suddenly decided that I will have them framed. But it was quite funny. And he was working on helping to build the camp, and you see. The thing, really, we, or at least we didn't know that, we didn't hear anything about it in our battalion, about these atrocities to the prisoners. And it wasn't...
Sorry, which prisoners?
To the English prisoners. We didn't hear about that, really. We all said, from what we'd experienced in Burma and what we'd seen, when we'd seen some of our chaps tied up, where they'd captured them, patrols, and they'd captured them and they'd hung them up with barbed wire and that sort of thing. We realised then that we didn't want to be taken prisoner, wouldn't like to be taken prisoner, but we didn't know about these prison camps and the state of the prisoners. As I don't think I would have given the Japanese soldier the cigarette. But anyway, I thought, well, you know, we all loved a cigarette, and so I gave him one, and I had the two pictures of the geisha girls, only just done on ordinary white paper, but the colouring, the actual drawing that he'd done, it's very effective.
He had done them, and
he bought them the next day and gave them to me. And I've decided now that I will get them framed. Since I've been doing this, I've looked at them, and I thought I would do something about it, have them framed. And I think probably my sons will be, or at least one of them might be very pleased to have them. And but. Going on from that, when my time came that I was going to leave the camp, I had to go for a medical. Our own MO gave me a medical. Well, I think really that anybody who could stand up and move about a bit, they passed you as A1. So I realise now that they didn't want to pay out too many pensions, I think. And I went to a hospital. They had a hospital at Kalor, and I went there for a medical dental check-up. It was a Japanese army dentist who checked my teeth to give me the okay, my teeth okay. So it shows you how things can change. And anyway, I came back from Kalor. And within a couple of days of that, I was on down to Rangoon, got the boat, and it was, the name of it, I'll never forget, was the Rena del Pacifico. And it was a boat that they had started, they had pretty well completed. It stood out in the water quite a way, and we had like a raft thing, you know, to take us out, and our luggage and that. They moved everything out to the boat like that, and I suppose the water, it was too shallow a water. I don't know much about Rangoon. I wasn't in there. And it just, you know, just went in one day and got the boat the next day, and so I didn't really know much about it. But this particular boat, we had a lovely journey home. It was just the Bay of Biscay that was bad, but we had a lovely journey home. And they put, you know, as she stood in the water at Rangoon, and the boat shone very nicely, and that it had mostly been painted white. They would, and going back home, they completed the job, and it was a funny thing, but that boat was in the news quite a lot. That I think that was its last run as a troop ship, and then it went, you know, as a pleasure liner, and but unfortunately it seemed to it was on the news and in the press, and it at a sad time there was always something wrong with it, I think it probably had a fire and one thing and the other, and after a time it just faded out completely, you know, but it seemed to have a very sad time after the war, and it was back as a pleasure liner, and got back I went to we docked at Liverpool, and then I went to down to Aldershot, to the barracks at Aldershot, and it was quite nice. I met some the chaps that had stayed in the army, and a sergeant who actually had gone out with me when I went out on draft, and he was back at Aldershot, and so therefore we had that evening a bit of a reunion in a local pub there, and the next day or so I went home and had just a weekend, I think it was, at home. And I'll never forget that the old lady that lived opposite my home, she was in a, she, her husband was a farmer, and they got a farmhouse opposite to the farmhouse that I lived in with my parents, and she was in her 80s, and which in those days was a good age really, and the taxi, I drew up in a taxi, and my goodness, she was out there like a rocket, and you know, hugged me and kissed me and made a terrific fuss, and my homecoming really, I remember that part of it better than any.
Do you remember the date?
No, I would say it was I actually finished in the army in June. So I would think it was somewhere in early June, I would think, of 19. That was in 46, and I. She said, "Oh, I'll take you to your mum. I'll take you to your mum." And it was funny, but we, you know, and quite honestly, you know, my mother was more shocked than anything, and she didn't make the fuss of me like Mrs. Elliot did, but. Anyway, I had a lovely weekend there at home, and then I went back. I forget I wasn't home many days, or about a week probably, and I went back there and to Aldershot, and then had a few days just hanging about there and getting documents done and that, and then went from there to Woking and got demobbed.
How did it feel being out of uniform?
I'd, I'd, I really missed it, and I did have promotion offered me twice while I, you know, in the army, and I did refuse it. But if it hadn't have been for my father, I would have stayed in it was a case of two things. I couldn't make up my mind whether to immigrate to Australia or whether to stay in the army. But my love had been the army. I did want to go as a boy, and if it hadn't have been for my father, you know, being so sick and I felt I had responsibilities, you know, to my family, I would have stayed in the army, and then I would have gone out for the promotion, because I would have you know anybody that had served and as a volunteer I would have I could have got promotion, you know, quite quickly, really.
What was your reason for not taking promotion?
I may be classed as selfish, but I was happy where I was. With the chaps in the mule platoon and with the mules and that, I was happy there. It was almost as if I were was still doing my civilian job in a way. And there's one thing about it. We all got on. All the chaps in the platoon, we all got on well together. And if I'd have taken the promotion, I would have had to gone from the mules into a rifle company. So that is really the reason that I stayed. And I think I had a lot to be thankful for from the mule platoon, because we had a lot of casualties. We had quite a lot killed, and we had a lot wounded in the battalion. And you know, with our muleteers, I'm absolutely sure that really we only had one killed, one muleteer killed. And that was, he got up out. We were taking cover in the elephant grass, and he got up out. You know, we thought everything was clear. We were being shelled and, you know, a lot of firing and that going on. And anyway, it went quiet, and this chap, he got up and, you know, presumed it was all clear, and he got up and he was shot, you know, through the neck, and he just went bonk, and that was finished. And he, as far as I can say, he was the only one. Now, I think by being with those mules, I think it might have been just fate, but I think I was lucky, really. And I could have very well. With a rifle company, you were there taking all the brunt of the firing and you were attacking and that, you know, and there was a lot of them killed, and there, as I say, a lot wounded, and I think I had a lot to be thankful for. And if I'd have gone, if I'd have taken the promotion, I would have had to gone forward and led some men. The officer didn't think very much of it, but I said to him, well, you know, that's how I felt about it, and he said, well, you know, fair enough, but I could have had the promotion very easy. As regards, you know, if I'd have stayed in, I think that's what I would have done. But if it, and certainly if it hadn't have been for my father's position, I would have definitely stayed in there. And then when I came out, I had toiled with the idea while I was in the army about going to Australia. And then when I got out, it's just how things happen. But I had quite a fling for a few years, and then I met my wife, and I said to her, well, you know, when we was on about getting married, I said, well, I'd like to go to Australia. What about going to Australia? Oh no, she said, I wouldn't go. She said, I wouldn't go out there while my mother was alive. And I said, oh, but anyway, you know, we married, and then when her mother died, I said, well, we can go to Australia now. But she said, oh no, she didn't think so. So, but anyway, we haven't had a bad life. No.
When you learnt about all the atrocities that the Japanese had carried out in their prison camps and so forth, how do you feel about it all today?
Well, I feel terrible about it. I'm a very soft-natured man, but that's one thing I just cannot forget or forgive, is the way they could treat those prisoners. As I said, we were lucky, really. We didn't know the awful things that was happening to those prisoners when we were fighting in Burma. But there's one thing about it. I saw some of our officers and men that had been out on patrol and didn't return, and I saw them the next day when they was hung up in the growth, and they'd been strangled with barbed wire. Now, what a torture. And that made me think then, well, I hope to goodness I never get taken prisoner by these people. But there's one thing, after the war and learning about the prisoners and seeing the photographs and the sight of those men, and I've read different books about them, and I feel really that I just cannot forgive them. And I'll say this, I've always said that I would never buy a Japanese car, and I've stood by that, and even today I wouldn't buy one of their cars. I think that they've been they've got away with so much in the world, and I think really that it's a pity. But what I can understand, they're young people. It's all been kept, or a lot of it's been kept away from them. They say, oh, they don't know about it. Whether this is true or not, I don't know. But really, what they've done to our people and our allies, the Australians and the Chinese and all the others. I think it's absolutely dreadful, and I'm afraid as long as I live, I'll never forgive them.